Chapter 2. Graduation. Children from my preschool typically went to a certain elementary school, but I went to a different one with a different feeder preschool. Most of the other children in my elementary school had known each other for years. I was wary of them. I didn't quite understand them. We would play marbles waiting for our parents after school. I crushed kindergarten, acing my report card every month. My teachers wrote effusive praise. They recommended advanced reading and mathematics courses. I was given a special evaluation and was told I would be entering an advanced math course. My mother and father were both proud. My father would help me with my math homework, teaching me a little extra every time. I gradually became friends with a pack of boys who loved role-playing as Star Wars characters. They would usually be honorable Jedi Knights, and I was a Sith Lord. I would use my mind control powers on them, force them to turn against each other and do my bidding. At night, I would lie awake and think of our games, and I would feel a tingling, an itch. It was the first time I remember being distinctly aroused. One by one, these boys individually confessed their crushes on me and told me they wanted to be my boyfriend. I was frustrated. I didn't want a boyfriend. I wanted a harem of boys I could mind control. Eventually, they grew jealous of each other, and we stopped playing together. This is one of my first experiences of a friendship being destroyed because a boy couldn't get over his romantic attraction to me. Throughout my life, this has been one of the most painful things to experience. A man confesses to me that he's in love with me. When I express disinterest, the relationship is poisoned and withers. To lose out on opportunities because an idiot man couldn't keep his boner in his pants is infuriating. To have a sexual relationship framed as the price of admission, told I am lucky to receive the attention, despite knowing that they have mentored plenty of fellow men before, with no blowjob required. I think of all the things I could have done, all the things so many women could have done, had men simply let their longing go, and I feel a fury flare in my belly. Around the end of my first grade, the old pastor at my church retired, and the church decided on a woman as the next minister. My father was enraged. I was confused. I liked her. She made me laugh during her sermons. My father felt that a woman pastor went against the word of the Bible. Women were too irrational and unstable to lead. He protested, but everyone ignored him or even laughed at him. Emasculated, he decided that we needed to find a more traditional church, a church that respected men. Only now can I see how small and angry he must have felt to insist on such a thing. The church he decided on was, ironically, only a few years old, but it claimed that it was dedicated to the truth of Christianity, a truth that had been forsaken somewhere along the way. It was operated out of a local community center on the weekends, sermons taught in the auditorium, Sunday school in the classrooms. This new pastor had a very academic style of sermon, often discussing the Hebrew or Greek origins of various words, why they were translated in a particular way. The Bible was taken quite literally, as an absolute truth, which was quite magical to me at the time. I read it from end to end over the summer of second grade, feeling guilty as I skimmed the boring genealogies. I slept with it beside my pillow, reading it before I went to bed and when I woke up. Obviously, the Bible is not an appropriate book for a child to read, with its lurid descriptions of incest and violence. I remember asking my mother a few too many questions about animal sacrifice and Lot's daughters. She was unnerved, but I was hooked. It is strange to me that my conservative parents allowed me to read such a naughty book as the Bible. So many people forget the overwhelming horniness of Song of Solomon. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. My beloved thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. Once I finished reading the Bible, I became insatiable. I wanted to read about other religions. The library near me had an entire section of children's books about other mythologies, and I devoured them. Among my favorites were Anansi, the trickster spider god, the story of Persephone and how her mother wept for her, creating winter, and the tale of Osiris with its drama, betrayal, and rebirth. My elementary school art teacher, Mrs. Smith, encouraged this fascination, drawing from mythologies from around the world in her explanations of different art histories. I would linger in her classroom, pestering her with questions about fauvism or Aphrodite. She was always so kind. I asked so many questions as a child. Educators like to talk about the different ways people learn: kinetic, verbal, visual. I needed everything. When I was younger, I loved the outdoors. I put everything in my mouth. I wanted to know what the leaves of my favorite maple tree tasted like. I ate grass. I pulled wild onions out of the dirt and put them, unwashed, into a muddy stew along with dandelion leaves and other plants I read about being edible. Of course it was disgusting, but I loved it. I would often be covered in mud, knees bleeding from climbing trees, hair an absolute mess. There was a snake living in the park nearby that was incredibly alluring to me. It was a simple garter snake, and I loved watching it. My parents told me to keep away from it, or it would bite me. I would leave small bites of food for it in the rocky area I knew it lived in. One day, while taking a break from playing, I rested my hand on a rock. The rock felt fleshy and warm to the touch. I looked down, startled to see that I was actually resting my hand on the snake. I lifted my hand, and she slowly slithered away. She seemed to have no desire to bite me, a gentle creature. Throughout my childhood, I was intrigued by snakes. I was always confused why people were so afraid of them. There was the snake in the Garden of Eden, and the evil lady who can transform into a snake in the Chronicles of Narnia. A friend of mine had a pet snake, and I would watch it curl around my arm, appreciating its smooth warmth. Perhaps I've always been inclined to be curious about things that frighten others. I remember a boyfriend once getting angry that I called his cock cute, but to me it was. A soft, gentle, sweet cock. He wanted me to think it was large, perhaps even threatening, but I couldn't. I think I'm drawn to men in general that are sweet and feminine. I myself am so masculine and intense. I want to be the pursuer, the top, the one in control. I might look soft and innocent, but I'm hardly a submissive. When my mother would take us to the park as children, I would usually amuse myself by climbing trees. There was one tree in particular which was my favorite, and I would leave her little flowers, sticking them in her rough bark. One day, when my mother called to us, asking us to get ready to come home, I refused. I hid in the tree. She came to the base and called up to me. "This tree is my mother," I told her. "It's my home now. I won't be coming with you." She left, and an hour or so later, I walked home. I was chaotic and messy, but I did have a sort of intellectual rigor behind the chaos. My grandmother and father taught me about different plants native to the Northeast. We would go on walks and discuss the surprising lemon zing of wood sorrel. I would identify some poison ivy, then pepper my father with questions. I knew my skin would erupt into a painful rash if I touched it. But what if I ate it? Perhaps my favorite thing about my father was how he humored my questions. We would talk about why poison ivy caused such a reaction, ways to prevent it, laundry detergent could break down the oils, particular reasons why the body would react so violently to it, why immune systems were so delicate, and how an overreaction or underreaction could prove fatal. Usually, I would ask him questions about how different things worked until it was time for bed. He would sit at the foot of my bed, fielding questions till we got all the way down to quarks. I would ask him endless questions about quantum mechanics, which he would do his best to answer until he didn't know anything further. He would then tell me that perhaps one day I would be the one to figure out the answers to all those questions. I would fall asleep, imagining myself in a lab somewhere, peering through a microscope, writing notes and reading endless studies. As I grew older, it became harder and harder for me to reconcile this part of my father, who always encouraged my curiosity and questioning, with the religious and deeply moral father, who insisted that dinosaur bones were placed underground as God's method of testing our faith. I became extremely cocky in class. I had a genius IQ, and I knew it. They did their best to challenge me, but I was growing bored. My second grade teacher hated my guts. I would read books under my desk in school during her math lessons. She would yell at me for reading, say I wasn't paying attention, then ask me to solve the math question on the chalkboard. I would look up, smirk, and answer it, then go back to reading. What could she do? I cringe looking back at what a dick I was. So many of the adults around me told me constantly that I was a generational talent, that anything I decided to do with my life would change the world. Once, I was at a dinner party with a few of my father's friends. A man asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. "A quantum physicist," I said, sipping my water. "Do you even know what that is?" he asked, drunk and stupid. "I borrowed a book from the library about it. I'm fascinated by the idea that electrons don't exist in a single point location. My dream is to work on finding the Higgs boson." "Do you know what that is?" I replied, with all the condescension I could muster. My father laughed as the man flushed red and mumbled something. "Wise beyond her years, isn't she?" Sometimes I would beg my mom to let me shave my head, or at the very least cut my hair short. I hated my long hair. It was always getting in the way and getting tangled, and it hurt to brush. I would pull at it and cry. My mother was irate and told me that girls have long hair and boys have short hair, and that I was a girl, so I had to have long hair. My mother would take me shoe shopping whenever I outgrew my shoes. My feet were always small growing up, so I never got to buy shoes that looked like the ones girls my age were wearing. The shopkeeper would measure my feet and direct me to a particular aisle where all my options were hot pink and glittery. Hot pink and glitter were no longer chic. I was a mature first grader. I wanted shoes that were cool. My mother caved and let me shop in the boys' section. I picked out plain gray leather sneakers. I could feel an illicit sense of naughtiness and transgression as I wore them walking down the street, wondering if anyone could tell that they were meant for boys, not girls. Being seen as a woman always chafed. I didn't fit into the mold, and I resented being pushed into it. I just wanted to be whatever I was. There was one boy that year that I did have a crush on. I would walk over to his desk and come up with excuses to talk to him. We had playdates and built an elaborate train set together, drew with crayons, spun his father's globe in the living room, and pointed at places we wanted to travel to. His grandmother made us some rice and steamed veggies, and I gobbled them up. At the end of each playdate, when my mother came to pick me up, I gave him a kiss on the lips. His grandmother watched, smiling. He would come find me at school and kiss me when out of view of the teachers. He moved away the following year. I hated the girls at this school. They were vapid and blonde, like their mothers, preppy and boring. I missed May May. Even going to different elementary schools, we continued our playdates until her father was transferred to his company's branch in Hong Kong. My mother made me join Girl Scouts. We were daisies. The mothers were all friends with each other, and the girls too. My mother stuck out like a sore thumb, and so did I. I would protest before every meeting, crying hysterically, begging my mom to let me stay home and read. We went on a camping trip, and I terrified the other girls with a horror story late at night in our tent. The other moms complained to my mom, but I didn't know how to be anything other than the person I was. These girls were babies. My teacher asked my mother if she wanted me to be moved up 2 grades. I begged her to say yes. I was friendly with some of the older girls anyways. We had more interests in common. My mother shut it down. She didn't want me to be socially stunted. I was permitted to take certain advanced classes, but was still grouped with other children my age. I was often very angry. I would get into fights with my brother constantly. My parents were vexed. One day, they took a video of us after a fight. Do you remember why you were mad at your brother? My father asked me, my face cold and angry. I hate him. My father's voice in the video. I'm going to show you this in 5 years. Do you think you'll remember what he did that upset you? Of course, I replied. It's awful. Years later, my father did replay the video for me. I was mad he took my favorite spoon, I said. He used it for his applesauce and he wouldn't let me have it. My father was disturbed at the clarity of my memory. I think sometimes my parents did act carelessly around us, assuming their misdeeds would be forgotten in a few years. But I remembered everything. And of course I remembered that spoon, sterling silver, given to me by my grandmother. I've always been petty. I felt the adults in my life regarded me as monstrously precocious. Precocious to the point of being dangerous, a loose cannon, a powerful force that needed to be broken and reined in like a wild horse. They would stare at me from afar and whisper. Around this time, my father started teaching my younger brother C++. Curious, I wandered over and watched them. My brother, with a short attention span typical of a 5-year-old, lost interest quickly, but I was totally obsessed. C++ was a newer programming language that my father was very excited about. He taught me the basics of programming quickly. He used to be a professor while in grad school and had a passion for teaching. Together, we made a tic-tac-toe game that learned from you as you played against it. It remembered all the previous strategies you used and would either use them against you or prevent you from executing them. My father remarked that he was surprised a girl was so into computer programming. My mother, before she became a stay-at-home mom, was an electrical engineer who designed circuitry for consumer electronics like refrigerators. Despite this, I fully bought into his sexism. I considered women weak, physically and intellectually, incapable of rational thought. My father and I agreed that the only logical woman in the world was Ann Coulter. I let myself believe that I was exceptional and that no one would look down on me for being a woman. My brilliance was obviously self-evident, I felt, even though my father had initially decided that I wouldn't be interested in computers. I believed the easy lie of meritocracy. My mother was displeased with my interest in computers. She had decided to quit her job in large part due to the overwhelming sexism and sexual harassment she experienced while working as an engineer. She would show me photos of her working in Taiwan, and I would ask why she left. She told me that she thought I should stay away from tech, that it would be too hard. At the time, I thought she meant that it would be a technical challenge, that she thought I wasn't smart enough, but now I understand that her meaning was not so straightforward. I became enmeshed with my computer. I would spend hours playing in the terminal, writing little scripts. At the time, the only computer I had was a Linux machine. Red Hat was certainly not designed with children in mind, but I had fun playing all the open-source games I could find to download onto it. Eventually, I built a computer with my father and started running Ubuntu. I used to love chatting online when I was younger and terribly lonely. I would spend hours every day on forums, chatting with strangers who happened to share my interests. I learned HTML and CSS so I could build elaborate web pages on Neopets. My mother was very opposed to me spending too much time on the computer as a child. She thought it resulted in me reading fewer books. My father intervened on my behalf. "I've watched what she does online," he said. "It's still reading, just on the screen instead of on paper." In this age of computers, the autist is the new magician, intuitively communicating with the divine. Autism is a change in empathy. It is an empathy overload. Regular humans can empathize easily with other humans, whereas autistic people empathize with whatever their system of obsession is, be that humans or trains or computer chips. Just as neurotypical people might watch a rom-com and feel their heartstrings tugged by the music and the acting, an autistic person can get into the mind of any system, intuitively predicting its ebbs and flows. When I was young, I had the traditional autistic obsessions. I loved my computer and playing Pokemon and train simulators. I had a few friends besides those I shared interests with, mainly nerdy boys, and those I barely engaged with, preferring to read or play on my computer. For the most part, I felt that they couldn't understand what I was talking about. In second grade, my teacher had a long talk with my mother about this. She was concerned about my social development. My mother told me I must make friends. I was annoyed. I started scoping out the girls in my class, trying to see who might be a good candidate as a friend. One girl, Natalie, stood out, but she already had a best friend. I eavesdropped on them one day in line. They were discussing who the best Disney princess was. How could I be friends with someone who only wants to talk about Disney princesses? I thought. I was frustrated. I felt no girls my age could possibly hold a conversation with me about anything I would enjoy talking about. But just like hiding my queerness, I knew that if I did not make friends with the other young ladies, something bad would happen to me. I began to observe them. I learned to smile at the appropriate time, how to time a joke to get maximum laughs. Eye contact was the most challenging, but I learned to push through my discomfort to meet people's eyes. I read obsessively about how people related to each other, their body language, and what their body language communicated. I read books about psychology and how to be a good friend. I did my best to learn the system of normal human interactions and how to mimic it. Eventually, I went on a playdate with Natalie and her best friend. Both of them were in my Girl Scout troop. I played with their dolls and we drew with crayons. I forced myself to learn how to appreciate it. Autistic girls are less likely to be diagnosed than boys, and they are more likely to have developed skills that allow them to blend in. What would I be like if I had been allowed to pursue my natural interests without being forced to do the tedious work of learning to pretend to be normal? You could say autistic boys are perhaps too coddled. I am infuriated when a man is allowed to get away with creepy behavior just because he's on the spectrum. Having been forced to learn basic social decorum, I know it's possible to learn. I wish there was a middle ground where I was still allowed to be a little weird, but still taught how to not act like an asshole, and boys were taught the same. Some people are surprised when I tell them I'm autistic. I explain to them that most of what is handled in the background of people's brains while interacting is in the forefront of mine. I will point out how they are holding themselves, the placement of their hands, the tension of their back, and what it communicates to me, and then explain how I'm holding my body and the intent behind my body language. One-on-one, I can pass relatively easily, but in group settings, especially large group settings, my ability to process all the variables degrades rapidly. My contributions to the conversation are grating, my body language not quite the right vibe, my laughter not properly timed and a little too loud. I have not been able to maintain a friendship with a neurotypical person for more than 4 years. That is the point at which any relationship begins to irrevocably degrade. I think that they can tell I'm a little off somehow, that I'm faking it. Something about me sets their teeth on edge. Uncanny valley, strange alien, desperately trying to be human.